All right, let me tell you what's happening. First of all, we are going to have a conversation in just a few minutes, or just a few moments, ideally, with Alex Beam, author of a new book about Joseph Smith. At the moment, though, Alex is lost in the corridors of WGBH, and he and the engineer are trying to find one another. So let me tell you about a few other things. First of all, let me just say that ordinarily, at this point in the show, we have an introductory sketch involving Kyone Wolf and often Greg Hill. And we thought about doing it today. And obviously, there's obviously a template even for doing humor about Joseph Smith, because the biggest hit on Broadway over the last few years has been The Book of Mormon. It didn't seem right somehow. And one of the things that Alex's book does and that we want to do here today is explore some of this stuff, you know, in a pretty even-handed way. I think Alex does a pretty good job of this as well. Embracing neither the Mormon side nor the anti-Mormon side. And so it just didn't seem like it would be great for a sketch. Let me also just take this moment while we're trying to locate Alex to tell you a little bit more about what's coming up in the next couple of days. We will be talking tomorrow to Paul Teeger. Paul's an expert and a researcher on personality types, best known through the Myers-Briggs matrix of personality types. We've all had Paul on a bunch of times before, and whenever we do, we get a lot of phone calls, we get a lot of interest. In particular, we're going to focus with Paul and his daughter, who's now kind of gone, she's kind of gone into the family business, on a new version of an older book called Do What You Are. It's an attempt to match that kind of thinking about personality types with career choices. And so anyway, we'll be talking about that. We welcome your phone calls. We were going to try to get an online quiz up about that so that people could even sort of type themselves a little bit and get ready. I don't know if that's actually happened yet, but stay tuned to WNPR.org for that. Friday, of course, is the nose. We'll tell you more about that as the days go by. All right, I think we have him now. Our guest is Alex Beam. He's a columnist for the Boston Globe, but more relevantly, the author of American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. Alex, is that you?
It is I, Colin.
What a relief. I thought I was going to have to talk about Joseph Smith for 48 minutes or so, which I could do.
I think you would do a terrific job.
I could do it if I had to. I've read the book. I'm well informed. So, you know, it's almost difficult to know where to start and how to start, just in the sense that how much Joseph Smith 101 do people need? But and I might rely on your expertise about that. You're having gone around and talked to a lot of people and maybe had getting a sense of how much of this story the average person knows. I'm assuming we have to do a little bit here at the beginning to sketch out the biographical details of this guy.
Yeah, I mean, I really wrote this book from zero, and I'm fairly well informed. I even knew the family of Fawn Brodie, who's Joseph Smith's greatest 20th century biographer. But I've done a couple of book talks now, and this sort of the second thing I do, which I really can't duplicate on radio, alas, is I kind of wave my arms around, you know, and I extend my left arm as far as it goes, and I say, here's Sharon, Vermont, mm-hmm. where Joseph Smith is born, and then I trace the Mormon's progress to the Mississippi River, where the action of my book takes place, you know, and then I use my right hand to be Utah. I mean, yeah, Joseph Smith, you know, was born a poor farm boy in Vermont, and had a rather unusual, you know, as a teenager. First of all, he was a treasure hunter. In fact, mm-hmm. he was even prosecuted by the law because he would go to these people's farms. These kinds of superstitions were very big at the time. He'd go to people's farms, charge them a little bit of money, and says, "I'll find the buried Spanish treasure in the hill, you know, behind your pasture." They would pay him, and he wouldn't find the treasure, but he would say that the treasure had been moved by spirits. In any case, you know, he went on from that to, you know, seeing angels in his sleep, seeing angels as a teenager, and then eventually he received the Book of Mormon from the angel Moroni.
And that happens in upstate New York, right?
Yes, that happens in Palmyra, New York. In fact, someone just texted me a picture of Hill Cumorah, which is a Mormon shrine that I haven't visited, but Joseph was told many times by an angel or several angels that he should go to this spot on the hill and dig, and he would find plates the angel Moroni was one of the defeated Nephites, one of the two tribes that came to America in the Book of Mormon, blah, 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 anyway. And Joseph did as he was told. It took him 9 months to kind of assimilate these instructions. He purportedly dug up the golden plates, you know, took them to his home. And then since he actually couldn't really read or write, he recited, you know, through inspiration, he recited to his wife and to the first of many scribes who played roles in his life, he recited the Book of Mormon.
And so, by the way, as we go along here, if people have questions, comments, or maybe actual Mormons listening, we'd love to hear from you, 2-860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. And I don't want to dwell over much on this because this really isn't the meat of your book, Alex. But the story goes that he has not only received these plates, which nobody else gets to see, but he has these kind of seeing stones, right? These kind of decoder stones somehow or other, which allow him to read and understand a language that he wouldn't otherwise know.
Right. The angel left him with the plates, left him the magic spectacles, which I find it hard to pronounce, but I think it's the Umim and Thurim. And the reason I mentioned the so-called scrying or treasure hunting earlier is because there's his detractors and even reasonable people can draw a straight line from, you know, scrying. These are all kind of synonyms for dowsing, you know, finding things that are buried was sort of his illegitimate profession before he became a prophet in, you know, who had received the Book of Mormon from God. So the present day Mormon Church, the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, is hardly eager, you know, when people bring up these court cases from 1823 and 1824 where, you know, sort of disappointed clients of Joseph Smith's say, how come he didn't find the Spanish treasure in my backyard like he said he would?
Well, it seems to me that there are two things going on here right at the beginning of the founding of this faith. On the one hand, and, you know, we can go into some more details about the subsequent iterations of Joseph Smith's prophecies and how he moved his flock around. But we're at a time of real religious foment and a lot of religious origination, too. There are a lot of religious movements going on in America. We can talk a little bit about that. And then he's up in an area that I picture anyway at the time up in Palmyra, New York, which is kind of on the edges of American civilization as opposed to right at the heart of it. And if we believe the historian David Hackett Fisher, the more outlying the area you got to in those days, the more there was a lot of kind of magical thinking that went on. And so you had Joseph Smith up there and he's dowsing and divining and scrying and doing all this stuff, which may seem a little outlandish right now, but probably didn't at the time.
Yeah, that's exactly accurate. And it's odd what, you know, one learns late in life. But I mean, what I learned sort of anticipating is that, you know, the action of my book actually takes place on the American frontier, because the American frontier is the Mississippi River at this time, you know, well before 1850, when the trans-Mississippi states are brought into the Union. But that also holds for upstate New York, as you say. The Erie Canal is only just being dug. In fact, Joseph Smith's mother makes some money sort of selling lemonade, if you will, or selling provisions to the men who are digging the Erie Canal. So this is it's very, very far away. As you know, it's called the Burned Over District because so many sort of crazy evangelicals with questionable claims, you know, to seeing fire, seeing God, entertaining Jesus Christ, are having a lot of success in this remote part of America that's far from the actual cities of Philadelphia, Boston, and New York.
And it seems to me that another thing that is happening right now is that along with the physical frontier, there is a theological frontier that's being explored, too. So you've got, you know, this so-called Second Great Awakening. You've got a proliferation of often individual people who have their own version of Christianity or something resembling Christianity. You mentioned the Millerites who actually, I think— the modern day Seventh-day Adventists, or to a certain degree anyway, kind of an outgrowth of the Millerites. The Campbellites come over from Scotland. They are manifested today in the Church of Christ, and a bunch of other lesser well-known things that are going to fizzle out.
Even the Shakers, of course, right. Which everyone's heard of.
And then as the century goes along, you have the beginnings of the two or three other American-founded religious movements that are going to persist. Christian Science, Seventh-day Adventists, Jehovah's Witnesses all start later than Mormonism, kind of more in the 1870s. But really, the whole 19th century is a time at which people feel free to experiment religiously or proclaim things religiously, because the established religious order, only sits in some of these established seats, and there is a frontier to be explored, right?
That's exactly true. I sort of want to say two things. I mean, one thing that's behind your remarks, of course, is that new Americans are arriving in North America, who, the original colonies, I'm so embarrassed. I think Fisher also wrote Albion Sea.
Yeah, he did. Yeah.
Where he points out that five different religions founded colonies in America. But by the time we're talking about the sort of the first half of the 19th century, there's a whole new wave of immigrants that really have no use, for Puritanism or whatever they're up to in Virginia, the religion of William Penn. So, I mean, Joseph Smith and others, which is genuinely interesting, and as you say, are founding American religions. Of course, Joseph Smith's religion is arguably the most American of all. We'll get to that in a second. But yeah, they're creating sort of new religions, new non-European religions, taking the European religions as their base. I want to make one quick point, because I don't really get into this in the book, and people ask me, and it's quite legitimate, which is, if the Millerites and all these other people are running around, Ann Lee and the Shakers, why is Joseph Smith successful, more successful than his competitors? Because let's face it, this is a business, and he wins. He gets more business than anyone else. And in a way, it'd be great if I had a really smart answer to that. But I think a partial consensus is that he had, and I hope this doesn't sound trite, but that he had a book, and that was really a big deal. There were a lot of fiery preachers around, who spoke with the word of God, surely Joseph Smith among them. But this creation of the book, to be perfectly crass, was a really interesting selling point for gathering converts.
I mean, I would also say that if I were there at your book talks, I would also respond. I would object to the premise of the question to a certain degree, because yes, Joseph Smith is the most successful in the sense that there are 15 million or so worldwide Mormons today, and that's a lot.
14. I don't mean to be a jerk.
All right. Well, no.
Okay. I'm a jerk.
I'm the last person to sit here and split hairs about the number of Latter-day Saints there are, but 14, 15 million followers. So he's a big winner that way. But compared to Thomas and Alexander Campbell, compared to almost anybody else we can think of, the founders of the Jehovah's Witnesses, Mary Baker Eddy, Anley, you pick your. Those people didn't get assassinated. So, in some ways, he's not the big winner. And I hope, by the way, Alex, by the end of the show, we'll be talking a little bit about the degree to which modern Mormonism is simply an extension of Joseph Smith, and the degree to which modern Mormonism, or modern LDS, is something that has essentially outstripped and outlived Joseph Smith. And I think you can kind of make both arguments, but we'll come to that. But it's not necessarily the case that he's successful in all the ways you want to be successful, like living, for example.
Well, Colin, I mean, my dear friend, I mean, arguably the greatest preacher of the last 2,500 years died at age 33, mm-hmm. right? So, as the somewhat jumped up title of my own book yes. intimates, I mean, dying in this manner, it is a form of success.
Well, but I guess I would say that the dying isn't an isolated incident. To a greater degree, probably, than any of the other religious movements that you and I just rattled off, this group from the time they're in Missouri to the time they're in to Illinois are suffering constant harassment and persecution, even as, and this is something that your book really revealed to me, even as in other ways Joseph Smith is achieving a kind of temporal significance that, I wouldn't have expected that he had. We're kind of getting ahead of our story here. What should we do? Should we just quickly jump through the migration from Kirtland to Missouri?
I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, there's a chapter in my book, as you know, called Everybody Hates the Mormons. And when I try to explain what's in my book, I do try to explain this disturbing pattern. I mean, the Mormons are tossed out of Kirtland, Ohio, their first settlement, because Joseph has this harebrained idea of starting a bank that bankrupts everyone in the entire town.
The ominously named Kirtland Safety Society Anti-Banking Company. Never put your money in an anti-banking company.
You'd really want to have your money in that company. I mean, he literally flees Kirtland under the dead of night, and then he goes to his own Zion, the place that he's declared to be the Garden of Eden. He takes all of his followers, who at that time number in the hundreds, to the state of Missouri. They cross the Mississippi, and to make a long story short, they get chucked out of Missouri. You know, the governor has the extermination order, which means it doesn't mean we're going to kill you. It means we're going to chase you out of Missouri. They get chucked out of Missouri. They're forced to flee to Illinois. My book starts with this kind of thriving Mormon colony in Nauvoo, Illinois, which is as far away from the center of American power as you can possibly get. There's no state. It's the westernmost place in the settled United States. And of course, I mean, as I will write in this book, I mean, they're going to get chucked out of here too. So, I mean, the Mormon trek to Utah is an act of incredible desperation, where the Mormons are in fact fleeing the country they hate, the United States.
But, you know, in between, he does do these remarkable things. And having suffered this incredible setback in Missouri, where they lose all this land, they lose all kinds of things, they get chased out of Missouri, he buys this really crappy land on the river in Nauvoo that is marshy. It is pestilential, so pestilential that as Mormons arrive, they're, you know, dying at this alarming rate from spotted fever. But he drains the marsh, and he creates this sustainable city, which right at the end of his time there is the most populated city in Illinois. Is that right?
Yeah. It's larger than Chicago at its time. Chicago hasn't yet populated. There's between 10 and 12,000 people there. But as you know, it's not a fortress, but it could be, because outside of this city, you have this incredible – the population has really, over the 5 years that Joseph has settled his people there, they've really come to hate the Mormons.
Now, before we go to break, let's just sort of establish a few other things. So one of the things that distinguishes Joseph Smith, although not from lots of other prophets, but is that it's all about him in a lot of ways. He's seen these tablets that nobody else has seen. He's the person who has received these revelations, and these revelations are powerful enough and primary enough, as far as he's concerned, to constitute basically additions to the Bible, stuff that the Bible didn't get right the first time. He knows all this stuff now, and hence the Book of Mormon. So you've got that, and so you've got him as this unimpeachable, by his own people, source of authority. Everything he gets is straight from the Lord, so you can't really ask too many questions about that. And then as he begins to establish his temporal presence in Nauvoo, he kind of does the same thing, right? He just makes himself everything. He's all three branches of government plus the military, right?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's a theocratic city-state. I mean, everything that he rules is unbelievable. Yeah, I mean, he's head of the city council. He's head of the judiciary. He makes all decisions. I mean, it's important also to point out, you know, that Joseph Smith is kind of an amenable guy. You know, he's a friendly guy. He wrestles in the dirt with a bunch of people. He drinks plenty of whiskey. He's not a drunkard, but he's no stranger, even though he's received, you know, a revelation from the Lord called the Word of Wisdom about how people shouldn't drink coffee, tea, wine, and beer. He's truly a larger-than-life figure who reigns over this kind of cultish religion at this time.
Does he remind you of any present-day figure? Is there anybody or any sort of amalgam of people that you can think of now that he reminds you of? I have my own little answer to this.
Okay. I have only – well, I'll try to be relatively brief. Let me just say, reading the first 150 pages of Lawrence Wright's book about Scientology is pretty darn disturbing for someone who knows a lot about Joseph Smith. I'm just going to leave that on the table.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other, I mean, I have to say again, it doesn't dignify Joseph, but I mean that James Jones, there has to be something there, you know, sort of an analogy. I know not all of your listeners would remember, but he was a San Francisco kind of charismatic preacher who brought his people down to Guyana in Central America, and they all ended up dead.
Right. I had so much more benign an analogy that I was going to make. In your accounting of him, I mean, this isn't a precise resemblance. It's more of a spotty resemblance. There are certain things about him that remind me of Bill Clinton. You know, he's a man of appetites.
That's great. No, go on. That's great.
I mean, he's a man of appetites. He's a man who really kind of enjoys life. He's very charismatic, very good at persuading other people. And he's kind of good at adjusting the story, adjusting reality as things go on, kind of adding a new layer to what he's seeing so that accommodates the latest change in circumstances. Now, I mean, I'm not suggesting a one-to-one correspondence here, but as I was trying to picture who this guy was, and if I met him and I didn't have any big judgments I was going to make, and I wasn't going to compare him to L. Ron Hubbard or James Jones, like if I just thought he was, hey, this guy who kind of basically runs the show down there in Nauvoo, you know, who does he remind me of?
I think that's actually brilliant. I mean, so I salute you because, I mean, Clinton, of course, is this incredible merger, you know, of the sacred and the profane. I mean, Clinton is no stranger to the Bible. I mean, again, right. We don't have to lecture anybody here, but he's really in touch with, you know, Arkansas spiritual. He's in touch with spirituality generally, I think, you know, which endears him to African-American people. Anyway, yeah, I mean, Joseph Smith is politically pretty darned astute. Mm-hmm. I know that the opposite case can be made, but many times he showed very sane and sober judgment, as did Bill Clinton.
And just before we go to break, I mean, the thing that was remarkable to me was that I had sort of pictured Joseph Smith as this real outlier in even sort of in terms of like what anybody knew about him that he was this constantly this fringe person. But in fact, the New York papers wrote about him all the time, and he had embassies. He was sending out embassies to the Tsar and to England.
To France,
and,
yeah.
I mean, a very peculiar, quirky, and not necessarily mainstream operator, but he was really trying to operate somewhere within the mainstream he thought he was going to be president, among other things.
Yeah, I mean, he was a national celebrity, to
another,
be sure.
Another Bill Clinton analogy. They both ran for president.
They both ran for president. And Smith said if he'd lost, he would have run again. Alas, he was killed in the interim. But Smith was. I mean, the fact that he was a national celebrity, as I point out, you know, I mean, he confused that. You know, fame and notoriety are kind of easily mixed up. And, yeah, when he would get written up, although the New York Herald actually did love him, you know, but a lot of the people just had already heard that he had more than one wife, and they were starting to dig into that, shall we say.
Yeah. And I mean, some of his embassies to the outside world were a little peculiar. I know that he was offering the Tsar this dragon weapon that one of his followers had invented, right? This flame-throwing device?
The flame-throwing submarine or something. Yeah, the editor made me cut out a really detailed description of that because he thought it didn't make any sense. But, Joseph was corresponding with the Tsar. He loved to correspond with American presidents, but it's rather Shakespearean. You know, the fact is you can always write a letter to the American president. The question is whether he'll write you a letter back.
Right. And he also routinely got it wrong, too. Didn't he write to five different presidential contenders, omitting Tyler and Polk, the two that really would have been in a position to do him some good by actually being president? Anyway, we're going to take a quick break here. We're talking to Alex Beam. The book is American Crucifixion. When we come back, we're going to talk about, well, basically how it all went south in Nauvoo. So we're back. We're talking to Alex Beam, the author of American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. We'd be happy to hear from you. We've got one call on the line right now. We're going to go to some calls in just a second. Our number, 860-275-7266. 860-275-7266. You may tweet us at WNPR Colin. I think our tweet master, Greg Hill, somewhere in the house. All right, so Alex, we're picking up our story. It's the 1840s in Nauvoo, Illinois. Joseph Smith has established this colony here, this town that's actually a thriving town, and people are arriving in droves, not only from elsewhere in the United States, but even coming up the river from England, which he has sent missionaries. So things are pretty good, but then things aren't very good because there's this constant drumbeat of discontent with the Mormons. Now, where from does this come? Why does everybody hate the Mormons?
Right. It's a layer cake of reasons. And so I'll just tick them off one by one as they are in the book. The residents of Illinois initially greet the Mormons with tremendous generosity and openness of heart. Basically, to fast forward a few years, Nauvoo starts to thrive in a kind of not very economically successful part of Illinois. So there's already kind of, when someone's doing better than you, that's always a reason to dislike them and feel resentful and not like them. So there's a bit of Nauvoo has a certain amount of economic self-sufficiency, a certain amount of success, to draw the line forward. Mormons like to do business with Mormons. Mormons are pretty comfortable taking advantage of Gentiles, as they call them, non-Mormons. So there's a little bit of an edge there already on the economic front. Politically, the Mormons really enraged people in these Missouri counties that they kind of invaded because Joseph simply told them how to vote. So in Illinois, in a relatively small county, they could call the shots. Joseph could control 4,000 votes, 5,000 votes, so he could get anybody elected to the Illinois legislature. And even more, I mean, he actually, the Mormons, in some people's argument, controlled, say, who would become governor of Illinois. And so they were a huge voting bloc that always voted en masse, which really enraged anybody who lived around them because everyone else's vote was automatically nullified. Even though I go out of my way to say that this is not a particularly religious part of America, southwestern Illinois, they are, after all, adherents of a blasphemous religion. You briefly alluded to, Joseph is demanding canonical status for the Book of Mormon, and nobody, again, to be really crass, nobody knows where he pulled this out of. But he's also rewritten the Book of Genesis. He's added the Book of Abraham to the Bible. To the extent that there are, men of the cloth in Illinois, they're all just damning Joseph Smith to hell. Tremendous religious anger directed against the Mormons. And then lastly, starting in 1843, maybe even in 1842, the word is leaking out about polygamy. Polygamy is a secret doctrine that Joseph Smith is propagating among his most intimate, no pun intended, male friends and colleagues. He basically has started to whisper to them from 1843, God has told me that you need to take more wives. And this is being written about as far away as New York in the New York papers, old Joe Smith and his Mormon seraglio, because dissident Mormons have left Nauvoo even as early as 1842 and accused Joseph and his followers of having, 10, 15, 20, 30 wives. Now, and in fact, that is exactly what's happening, although in Nauvoo, it's still a secret. It's a shocking secret, in fact.
Including from Mrs. Joseph Smith, his first wife Emma Hale, maintains kind of deniability about this, right?
Yeah, she's the most shocked of all. I'm not trying to be facetious, but yeah, she's his wife of 12 or 13 years. And indeed, if you skip to the end of my book, when she's in her 70s, she will always deny, although this is psychological because she saw Joseph's young concubines with her own eyes because, four of them lived in the same house with them. But yeah, even, I mean, Brigham Young, his closest follower and his eventual successor, you know, when Joseph comes to Brigham Young and says, you know, you've got to take more wives, Brigham's famous quote is, you know, I that was the first time I desired the grave. Mm-hmm. It's truly, you know, shocking to these people who've embraced these new religions. And ultimately, you know, it will create a dissident movement within the church.
You didn't include these on your list, but I also wonder, I mean, in and among Joseph Smith's both political and religious ideas is a certain anti-slavery current and a rapprochement with Native Americans that probably wasn't very typical of Illinois settlers in the 1840s. Were those controversial? Did those add to his... to the kind of animus directed
yes,
at him?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, you've caught me out in that sense because on the first one is complex because even though, you know, Joseph's presidential campaign platform called for the manumission of the slaves, meaning that the slave owners would be bought out. I guess he was going to sell off the national parks or something and reimburse slave owners. I mean, he had a checkered record on African-American slavery. Because in Missouri, you could be shot. Indeed, you know, one of his newspaper editors was practically shot for advocating freedom for black people. On the Native Americans is unbelievably complex and fascinating. And yes, you happen to be exactly right. Joseph was. You could say unfailingly charitable towards Native Americans, some of whom were still on his side, although, you know, Abraham Lincoln and others had done their best to chase them across the Mississippi in the 1830 war, Black Hawk War. But there were a lot of Native Americans around on both sides of the Mississippi, and Joseph was extremely charitable to them, of course, because he thought that they were descendants of the Nephites, whom he writes about in the Book of Mormon. And you know, basically, all the non-Mormons in that part of the world hated the Indians.
So we've got all that, and so there's unrest, and we're going to have to sort of telescope a lot of what happened. But ultimately, it does wind up with, and maybe we should just quickly talk about one of the more complex figures in this story, Governor Thomas Ford, who is sort of. Well, I mean, I think your chapter heading compares him to Pontius Pilate, and he is kind of playing both sides of this question a little bit.
Right. I'm pretty hard on Ford. But Ford is this very pusillanimous figure. He refers to himself as the accidental governor of Illinois. What you're talking about is that basically Hancock County, where the Mormons are, is on the verge of bursting into flames. And Ford decides to leave Springfield, Illinois, the capital, and come down to Hancock County. And he perceives himself as an honest broker between Joseph Smith and the Mormons on the one hand and the so-called sort of angry old settlers, whom Ford secretly derides. Ford left a detailed history of all these events. He's a good writer, and he actually looks down on the non-Mormons basically as white trash from the South, sort of slave-driving white trash. But in any case, he goes down to Carthage, Illinois, which is really where the balloon is going to go up. And he pictures himself as somebody who can speak to both sides. And he ends up playing a very nefarious role. And basically, Mormons at the time and to this day regard him as someone who guaranteed safety to Joseph Smith and said that Joseph Smith, you know, would be indicted and prosecuted for certain crimes, but that his body would be protected, and then you know, Smith is of course murdered virtually in cold blood right under Ford's nose.
Although not literally under Ford's nose, in a bizarre accident of timing, and it seems to be an accident of timing, Ford is in Nauvoo talking to Mormons. He's up on his pedestal talking to the Mormons and kind of chiding them for, you know, not towing the line with the law and not being a little bit more cooperative and for some of the stuff that's gotten Smith into trouble and for not coughing Smith up a little faster once he did get into trouble. He's giving this speech to them almost at exactly the time this ragtag militia group is attacking the government building where Joseph Smith is being held and ultimately killing him.
Yes, and it's definitely clear that the mob, which is of course a shorthand for two or three separate ragtag militias, knew full well that Ford wasn't in Carthage, where Joseph Smith was in prison, and took advantage of that. It would have been arguably, it would have been impossible for them to kill Joseph Smith at that time if Ford, who is, of course, the commander-in-chief of all the men under arms in Illinois, period, it would have been hard to, you know, convince people to take up arms against fellow Illinoisians, et cetera, et cetera. So, yes, Ford, I mean, Mormon cynics, I'm not this person, but I guess Mormon cynics feel that Ford absented himself at a particularly propitious time, allowing Smith to meet his fate.
Although his argument was, I wouldn't have been standing there in front of thousands of Mormons if I knew that right at that time, you know, their leader was being killed. I mean, that wouldn't have been a good place for me to be in case word got back. But I just want to go back to these ragtag men, because, I mean, that actually could be a little bit misleading on our part, too. You know, how accurate is Thomas Ford's dismissive opinion of the people who wind up attacking this government building? Are they backwoods, moonshine-swigging? the phrase, yeah, no, a set of respectable men,
right,
crops up. Who are these guys?
Yeah, no, they're referred to as, well, they're the bourgeoisie. I mean, yeah, they're the small bourgeoisie. They're landholders, they're farmers, they're people, again, who, for the reasons that we discussed earlier, this sort of, you know, mille-feuille layer cake of reasons, they all hate the Mormons for various reasons. They are, you know, some of them are lawyers, some of them are future statesmen, both in Illinois and elsewhere. Although those seem to be the leaders, the people who say, you know, get the mob whipped up. I mean, just, you know, let's say there's five or six militias camped in Carthage, all of them probably fairly eager to do Joseph some harm. You know, the man who's at the head of each of those militias, you know, as you can appreciate, you know, knowing American history, is like some lawyer or some farmer, right? Mm-hmm. These are not armies. These are like the, you know, analogous to the men who fought at Lexington and Concord. And so the head of those divisions are the quote unquote, you know, the richest guy in some part of the county or something like that, or the guy who owns the most land or some lawyer, et cetera, et cetera.
And actually, one of the things that you sort of chronicle later in the book is that there's this sort of Mormon oral tradition about all the horrible things that happened to these people, and pus came out of their eyes and fell on their food that they were eating and stuff like that. But in reality, with the possible exception, with some notable exceptions, including Governor Thomas Ford, who really did come to a very bad and ignominious end, most of these guys, you know, I mean, there was a case, right? People versus Levi Williams or whatever, you know, for this lynching or whatever we're going to call it, this assassination of Joseph Smith. But basically, you know, nobody really paid the piper on this.
Right. I do sort of call it a lynching. I've never, you know, I probably maybe shouldn't be so loose with that term. But it seems to me, and indeed, you know, there's academics who talk about mob violence, the antebellum mob violence, which included a lot of lynching. This is a lynching of a white divine, if you will. The culpability issue. I mean, I have such a dark sense of humor that I find it's kind of laughable if it wasn't so horrible. It's pretty darned sure that we know the five people who actually, you know, pumped musket lead into Joseph Smith, and they all simply just crossed the Mississippi to the Iowa Territory the next day and were never found again. So there was this elaborate month-long show trial that you referred to, you know, Illinois v. Levi Williams, who's a very prominent citizen, had his own militia. And, you know, I believe there's nine defendants. I'm having trouble remembering. And there's this utterly ridiculous trial, you know, with a dipsomaniac prosecutor, an extremely able defense counsel, as usual, sort of like O.J. all over again. And these nine guys walk, you know. I mean, nobody, even though Joseph Smith is killed in broad daylight, nobody suffers any consequence for his death.
We're going to take a quick break. We're talking to Alex Beam. The book is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. When we come back, well, I mean, we're running out of time and we have so many more things to talk about. We'll only talk about some of them as a result.
The witness of Christ, faithful and true, he fulfilled his life's mission, a new dispensation of light. Had begun, giving his life.
Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me, Kyone Wolf. Our interns are Anna Novak and Tess Aronson. Greg Hill tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tolarski is our executive producer. The part of Bill Curry was played by Mitt Romney. For show pages, articles, and photos of the Faith Middleton show staff and their Masonic aprons, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, does your personality fit your job? And now, back to Colin.
All right, we're back. We're back with Alex Beam. One of the things I want to ask you about here in this segment, Alex, is how contemporary members of the Church of Latter-day Saints view the kind of research that you're doing. And before I even ask you that, we've got some calls coming in here at 860-275-7266, 860-275-7266. You can call in, too, or you can tweet us at WNPR Colin. Here's Matthew on the line from East Hartford. I believe you are a member of the Church of Latter-day Saints. Right, Matthew?
I am. Thanks, Colin and Alex. A great show. I'm a card-carrying member. So, when you first kicked off the segment, I was struck by the question, you know, why was Joseph Smith so successful? And I've kind of wondered, you know, here I am in the 21st century, would I have believed the stuff that Joseph said back then? And I like to think that I would, because a few of the things that he came out with, I think are novel to the world today. I mean, one of the things that he established, first and foremost, I guess I should say, is that, you know, Christ is at the center of the church, first of all. But he continues on with this prophetic tradition, and he does things that prophets do, like Noah and Moses and all of these old, you know, prophets that we all know about from our Bible stories. But he said some pretty amazing things. First of all, hey, I'm a prophet, and you don't have to believe me. You can read, for example, the Book of Mormon. And, oh, by the way, let me tell you about temple worship and priesthood authority. So in his day, he came out with some really novel things that we Latter-day Saints would say were sort of lost from the ancient Christian tradition. And he wrapped a bow around it and said, this makes sense. And the prophetic tradition kind of puts all of that in perspective. You know, you start off the conversation, Alex, with, you know, the treasure seeking and all of that, but I don't really think you can start the Joseph Smith story without beginning with the very first question that Joseph had, which was, you know, if there's one God and there's one Bible, then why so much confusion? And that's what starts the whole journey for Joseph Smith. He goes into the woods and he prays, and lo and behold,
yeah,
God.
I'm going to interrupt you with some. You're exactly right. I mean, I would, in my own defense, say that's not the first question that Joseph asked. However, you're right. It's the most important question. Joseph says, "Why are there so many churches?" And he's told by God that the churches aren't real, and he starts his own church. And I'm just going to make. I'm not trying to cut you off in any way, but a very important point you're making that we haven't gone over is that Joseph was this, and they played a song in the break. You probably heard it, which referred to the new dispensation. Joseph is talking about a restoration of the original values of the Judeo-Christian church in North America. Anyway, I don't want to cut you off.
All right. Yeah. Matthew, did you want to just wrap up what you were saying?
Yeah. Well, I would just say one other thing too, that you brought up was, you know, the concept of the harebrained idea of, you know, starting a bank. But in the context of the time, what was going on there was a ton of bank or a ton of land speculation. I think it's probably the equivalent of what we just recently went through with the financial collapse. And the Mormons were victims just like everybody else.
Oh, yeah. And that was my fault. I was the one who was.
No, he's right. I did call it here. I mean, you're all right. I mean, Matthew, you're exactly right. Of course, nutty banks are starting up. Yes, Mormons were victimized. However, I mean, when Colin read the name of that bank, you know, Joseph assigned that a rather duplicitous name. Matthew, it sounds like you know your history pretty cold. You know, he called it an anti-banking safety society because he knew it was against the law for him to actually start a bank.
You know, we're going to run out of time here. There's so many things that I want to talk about. And to my way of thinking, some of the most fascinating stuff in the book, the page-turner part really is the description of these militias mounting up against him and the attack and stuff like that. But I was just fascinated by the part of the book that deals with what happens after Joseph Smith is gone with no obvious successor and this incredibly complicated, you know, almost literally an American Idol search or to decide who was going to run off to sort of see who was going to take over. I don't know if we have time for that. But I do want to just get to the present, Alex. You did research about this all over the place, including Salt Lake City, anywhere that you could go to research this. And so, you know, I mean, Joseph Smith is problematic. He's a complicated guy, and there's a lot of the things that he says and does that, you know, maybe don't conform all that closely to how Mormons act today. I mean, in general, what was the level of receptiveness? How eager were members of the Church of Latter-day Saints to have you do a book like this?
Yeah, well, as I make clear, actually, at the very end of the book, curiously, you know, the Mormon Church did cleave into two churches after Joseph was killed. The sort of the polygamists, the polygamy faction went to Utah, the largest and most powerful faction, which is really what we call the Mormon Church now. But there was something called the Reorganized Church of Latter-day Saints that actually stayed in Illinois and Missouri. Curiously, they were incredibly nice to me. They invited me to come live at Nauvoo, which I did. The sort of the all-powerful Salt Lake Church was certainly more guarded in their interactions with me. They have a very well-funded church history library, and many of the documents I cite here, they've digitized them. They have so much money that you can read a lot of Joseph's original material on their website, although I went to the church history library twice. I mean, I would say they were relatively cool towards me. Having said that, you know, Mormons are extremely a diverse group of men and women, and the book's reception, you know, has been pretty welcoming because they're always kind of interested, you know, in what Gentiles have to say about them.
Well, and I guess that sort of, I mean, I have time really for a final, but a meaty question. To what degree is the Church of Latter-day Saints in 2014 the Church of Joseph Smith, an outgrowth of Joseph Smith and an extension of everything that he was? And to what degree is it a movement that's established itself in many ways that effectively outlive and outstrip everything that happened up to 1844?
Well, I think that's a very complex question, but I don't want to dodge it, and I certainly don't want to give any short – I mean, you go to Salt Lake City, which you probably have. There are statues everywhere of only two men, Joseph Smith and Brigham Young. So to make some kind of sophisticated argument, that the church has evolved or is more sophisticated than that would be missing a key point, which is that the Book of Mormon, Matthew can call afterwards to correct me. But I mean, I've been to Mormon church services, and you know, Mormons are required to give testimony. And ever so often, and they must say in front of other Mormons, "I know Joseph Smith to be a true prophet, and the Book of Mormon, you know, to be the Word of God." So, again, I almost from your question, I think you're talking about maybe policy peregrinations. Yes, the Mormon Church turned its back on polygamy in 1890, and again in 1910 because no one took them seriously in 1890. So, there are certainly elements of Joseph's teaching that the modern church has abrogated or abjured, but the gospel, I mean, not one word of it, you know, not the Book of Abraham, not the Book of Moses, certainly not the Book of Mormon. And I think the character, and I like your analogy to Bill Clinton, because I mean, I think this charismatic, somewhat welcoming character is very, very alive for Mormons today.
And yeah, I think that has to be the case. I mean, you even hear it in Matthew's question that this is a church. I mean, it's very much in the tradition, really, of a lot of American religions. As the Puritans came over here, the basic tenets of Calvinism said, well, if you're in communion with God, you know, you're really, you know, you're getting information that's every bit as valid and up to date as what's in the Bible, although that particular profession would have been considered a heresy in Puritan New England. But it's there, that notion that, you know, in some cases you can get in touch with God and just find out things. I mean, that's it crops up again and again.
I'm just going to interrupt you because, I mean, revelation, Joseph always preached revelation, you know, that men and women could seek revelation. And a tiny detail we haven't mentioned, it came up last night in a conversation. I mean, you know, Joseph spoke very, very optimistically about eternal life, and which partially explained the ceilings of polygamy and also he would adopt people into his family so they could all be together eternally.
We do need another hour because one of the many other amusing things about this, of course, is once you start that ball rolling, it's hard to stop. So you had Strangism. You had all these other people who would say, well, actually, I'm getting messages, too. And, you know, Joseph's not here anymore. And guess what? I know all this new stuff. Anyway, we don't have time to talk about that. We're all done. Alex Beam, the book is American Crucifixion, The Murder of Joseph Smith and the Fate of the Mormon Church. What fun, Alex.
Hey, thank you
for
having me.
I wish I'd studied with David Warsh more and less with Sidney Alstrom, and I'd be every bit as smart as you.
Oh, I'll never be as smart as you. But thanks for having me. It's a fun subject.
All right, thanks.